Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Welcome, everyone. Today, we have an informational meeting, but we're going to start off, since we've got a full contingent here, by opening a work session for possible... For possible bill introduction. Work session open. Sorry, I crossed signals with you there.
Madam Chair, you're going exactly according to our plan, so appreciate that. You have before you, let's see, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 LCs for committee bill introduction. Seven of those 10 are related to our tax credit sunset process, sunset extension process, and those have all been introduced in the House. So you're going to get a full set of those sunset extension bills here in the Senate, and they've done the same with the Senate one. So those are all presumably will have a subsequent referral to the Joint Tax Credit Committee.
Okay, so the motion that we're looking for now is just a motion to introduce as committee bills these LCs. Senator Morse?
As I understand, it would be the ones that are... All the ones that are listed?
Correct.
Madam Chair, I would move to introduce LC 3146, LC 3151, LC 3273, LC 3587, LC 3588, LC 3589, LC 3590, LC 3591, LC 3593, LC 3594 as committee bills.
Thank you, Senator Morse. And as we all remind ourselves, introduction does not mean that you're for or against a bill. It's a courtesy to the process to introduce these. Senator Morse has moved the aforementioned LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Okay, now we will move on to our next, our first agenda item, which is an informational meeting on federal reconnect issues. Should we open the public hearing? We'll wait on that. And we are, again, very fortunate to have representatives of the accountants, certified public accountants, headed by the much-esteemed Rob Douglas. So if you would like to come on up and start your presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Kim Spalding, and I'm here on behalf of the OSCPA taxation team. I'm a CPA in Portland. Our objective is to be a technical resource for you, as well as to advocate for conformity with the Internal Revenue Code. Conformity has in the past been done either through fixed date, as we have for 2009 or 2010 at this point, as of the date of December 31, 2009, or it can be a permanent connection, which is what we have for 2011 going forward. So we kind of have both at this point in time. What this booklet has, do you all have a copy of this booklet?
Yes, we do.
So this booklet contains federal law that's been enacted since your last session, and we have it broken out into different categories of A through D. Category A covers items that Oregon would be connected with automatically through its fixed date conformity. However, in order for that to happen, we need to roll forward the date to December 31st, 2010, and that's the purpose of the bill. Category B that we have in the tab covers items that don't impact Oregon because they're either a penalty or administrative provision or a credit that Oregon doesn't have. Item C we'll cover later in our discussion. Those are items that we need to take specific action on to either connect or to look at as far as staying disconnected from. And item D are just items that were referenced in the federal laws but don't really impact the tax law. So if you look at the very first introduction page, the items that Oregon is currently disconnected from and would remain disconnected from even with this bill are the domestic production activities deduction, the federal exclusion for federal subsidies for prescription drugs, the Section 179 expensing provisions and the bonus depreciation provisions, and the election to spread income from discharge of indebtedness. So Carrie's going to go over some information for you now.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I also am a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs taxation team and here representing the OSCPA. I think one of our concerns is that the tax laws in Oregon have become so complicated as to how they relate to federal law that even for members of our taxation team, we spent countless hours trying to figure out what is connected, what's not connected, and it's become pretty difficult because we've got these 2009 tie dates plus 2011 going forward should be back connected. Part of our problem is that we can only tie to the definition of taxable income. Anything else has to be a specific change in the statute so that we tie to anything that's not tied to the definition of taxable income, estate taxes, filing deadlines, penalties, credits, that type of thing. So I think make matters worse, as I said, we're tied as of December 31, 2009. The statutes that are all out there on the Oregon websites say that we're tied as of May 31, 2009 because they've yet to be updated. There's numerous times where we have said, wait, we're not tied as of December 31, 2009. And then, oh, yes, if we go back to the actual bill, we are. So I think there's so many times that the Department of Revenue is having to come in and clarify whether we're connected, how we're supposed to be reporting something for Oregon purposes. I thought I would share with you an email that we received from somebody from the Department of Revenue kind of telling practitioners what we needed to do in this upcoming session. If he's got, for tax year 2010, Oregon is tied to the definition of federal taxable income as of December 31, 2009. Couple that with a very busy congressional session in 2010, and we've got a great deal of uncertainty when it comes to filing the 2010 Oregon tax return. Then he goes on to say, at this time, if your client is affected by any of the issues listed below, there are two options. Delay the filing of the tax return until the legislature indicates its policy preference in this area, or option two, go ahead and file under current law. If you choose this option, an add back on the Oregon return will be required in some situations. Then he goes on to list a lot of the different issues. So we have this a lot of years, but in this year, we just have a lot of uncertainty. So we're being told, let's hold off on federal returns, and then there's a lot even later until we can file an Oregon return. And we've had issues already on how people are supposed to report earnings on for health care, issues on W-2s and that type of thing. So we're just starting to see more and more issues and concerns, and we're aware of them. I think a lot of practitioners are not aware of them, and certainly the taxpayer, I'm not sure how they would manage to deal with all of these different issues. So we really would urge Reconnect to the extent possible. The rolling Reconnect helps us to know from year to year what we're going to be facing and be able to pick things up and to help our clients early on in the year and to be able to file those returns. So with that, I think we're going to go through what we handed out as the top 10 sort of, rather than go through the whole book as we sometimes have in the past, just hit the top 10 items that we see that have come through in federal law. And we did hand out something that we'll go through, and I'll turn that over to Kim.
So in the booklet, Section A has asterisks in the effective date column of the items that Carrie referred to that the Department of Revenue mentions in their email. We're not going to go through those in detail, but you can refer to those to the extent you'd like to see all the different things we're disconnected from if we don't roll the date forward to December 2010. So jumping to tab C on page 27, the first three of our top 10 items that Oregon is impacted because of federal law changes relate to depreciation. The first is the bonus depreciation. The Hiring Act, the Small Business Jobs Act initially extended the 50% bonus depreciation, but then our new Tax Relief Act actually expanded that to be 100%. So for federal purposes, businesses can deduct 100% of what they purchase and place in service. Section 179 expensing, they did similar thing. They extended it originally, and then they expanded it so that now the deduction is even larger, $500,000. Oregon limits its deduction currently to $134,000. That's another example, though, of the difficulty in having different laws, because as a practitioner, I can't go in and look at the statute and see that our Oregon deduction is $134,000. I have to rely on what the Department of Revenue is telling us, because the Oregon law says the deduction will be the amount of federal law as in place as of 2008 as indexed for inflation. So it's very difficult to comply as a practitioner with the laws. Just something to keep in mind.
So the $134,000 was the $125,000 that was in effect for 2008 plus the rest is for inflation?
Indexed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The third depreciation item, which I believe we will tie to if you roll forward the date to 2010, expands the definition of what qualifies for Section 179 deduction and to include qualified real property, which most commonly would be something like household improvement. The fourth item on our top 10 list is actually not in our not in this bill, and it's not in this booklet, but we wanted to make sure that you're aware of it, and that is for taxpayers who wind up with a net operating loss carryback that includes bonus depreciation. They're going to get a deduction for bonus depreciation because federal net operating losses equal Oregon net operating losses. There's no difference for bonus depreciation. So on a regular tax return, a taxpayer would have to add back bonus depreciation as opposed to a net operating loss, they would not. So I believe the Department of Revenue has some guidance for taxpayers as to how to handle that going forward, but that's not always possible to the extent that the taxpayers are owners of pass-through entities such as S-Corps and partnerships, because they wouldn't have the records necessary to know how much to correct in future years for the prior year deduction for bonus depreciation for Oregon purposes. The fifth item on our top 10 list, the federal law enhanced the net operating loss carrybacks. Originally in 2008, taxpayers, only eligible small businesses were allowed to carry back 3, 4, and 5 years net operating losses. They extended that to 2009 and expanded it to additional taxpayers. So with that, Carrie's going to cover items 6 through 10 on our top 10 list.
What numbers are you going by? I don't see any numbers.
This is on a separate page.
Oh, okay.
Does everybody have that? We thought it just highlighted a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I think it ties a lot to the legislation.
I was trying to get that out of page 27. Okay.
A lot of them tie probably to the top economic issues as well.
I got it now.
So number 6, I think is... Most of you know that in December of 2010, Congress sort of unexpectedly changed the estate tax laws for 2010 and going forward. And so one of the concerns that we have is that if an individual elects not to have any federal estate taxes paid, then for income tax purposes, they have what we call a carryover basis. So if somebody had purchased an asset for $50 and by the time of their death it had gone up to $1,000, under prior tax laws, and as we are for 2011 forward, at the date of death would have a basis step up to $1,000. But if an individual elects under the federal tax laws to not have any estate taxes apply, they would have a carryover basis that would pass to their heirs of only $50. So we're set with this situation for federal purposes, but Oregon does not connect to this, to the estate tax provisions. But more importantly, they don't tie to this particular income tax provision. They wouldn't be a step-up in basis, or we'd have a carryover basis for Oregon purposes, and yet for Oregon, we have only $1 million exemption for estate taxes. So the individual would have paid Oregon estate taxes but not get a step-up, and so would again be subject to tax when the heir went to sell that asset. So we feel that this is a reconnect issue with an income tax. I think there is going to be a separate bill looking at this, but it's definitely an income tax issue that ties with it. In addition, because the new legislation came in so close to the end of the year and people really didn't know that this was expected, they have a delayed filing deadline so that it's at least 9 months after the date of enactment of the law, so which was December 17th. So there's an extension for filing of federal returns, and of course the Oregon estate tax returns are tied into that. And so from what we can tell, there needs to be a formal change in the deadline for filing returns. One extra little piece is in filing estate tax returns. A lot of people will do what's called a qualified disclaimer. Perhaps assets are supposed to pass from a parent to their child, and the child says, no, I'm going to let that pass on to my own child, to the grandchild, and a disclaimer has to be made within 9 months of the date of death. Again, federal law changed that to make it more flexible, so it could be 9 months after the date of the enactment, even if someone had died prior to December 17th. Oregon doesn't pick that up. And so we've got real differences for Oregon purposes and federal purposes. So
what are the revenue consequences, if any, on these changes? Maybe that's a Chris question.
I have a sheet with some estimates. I don't think number six would be large. But I don't have a specific number.
I'd like to just point out that I know in our office we have estate tax returns that would have an Oregon due date even within the next couple of weeks. If we don't, and you know, everyone's wondering, what do we do? Do we file this thing? Is Oregon going to tie to the extended federal due date? Is there tax due? It looks like from the statutes, Oregon actually doesn't require payment of the tax until the federal due date. So you would. It makes sense to go ahead and extend, I think as part of this bill for clarification for practitioners, the due date to tie with federal, which then also ties with the Oregon tax due date.
Okay, so this is basically about due dates rather than how your methodology for...
Well,
that's
for one
of many.
Three.
Yeah.
One of the three. The basis adjustment is different.
The basis adjustment will be a real issue that does impact income tax laws, which the Reconnect bill really is dealing with the income tax laws. And so there are a lot of different tie-ins with that federal. There is some step up in basis, some not. So I, you know, as you said there, I'm not sure what the economic tax consequence would be, but it does appear from what we can tell, and again, this gets back to where it's so complicated to try to know what the right answer is, but the tax payment wouldn't be required until it is for federal, but the due date would be sooner. So it may just be an easy fix to at least extend that due date, but we still do have the income tax issues and the disclaimer issues to deal with. So maybe those get bifurcated and some can be picked up in this Reconnect bill and some dealt with later.
So right now we're not connected to the basis, the federal basis changes, are we?
What we understand is that, and again, this is where we've tried to really look at it on our own and work with the Department of Revenue, but that if there's a carryover basis required for federal, we would to pick that up. So we are tied to that carryover and required to have that carryover basis, even though we paid Oregon estate taxes on it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
So what would happen to the exemption of $1 million versus $3.5 million?
The exemptions would still stay the same. This is just simply a matter of once the asset passes on to your child or grandchild, how much income tax do they pay when they go to sell the asset? So the exemption would stay at $1 million. You know, whether that changes, that's unrelated to this.
Okay.
Before all these changes in the estate tax, it's my understanding that at the federal level, the basis was reset under the old.
Yes, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. And so was Oregon's basis reset as well?
Yes.
And that was a connection?
Under the old law.
It probably, yes, it would have just been picked up as the basis, so it would have carried
and
over.
And so I never did fully understand what Congress did in 2010 regarding the basis. I know what they did in terms of the threshold and the rate, but what did they do in the basis in 2010, and how does that affect us?
So at the time when the state taxes effectively were gone at a federal level for 2010, because there was no tax, they said then the heir is going to receive a carryover basis. So we're not going to tax you at the time of death, but when your heir goes to sell that asset, we're going to tax them. So that only for the year 2010 for federal purposes, there would be a carryover basis. Now, when the new law came in at the end of December, Congress said we're going to let you elect whether to apply that law where there's no estate tax and a carryover basis, or we're going to give you a $5 million exemption and you're going to get a step up. And so you basically can elect which way to go.
Oh, okay, but for 2010?
Only 2010. And then 2011 going forward, everyone's under the $5 million exemption and an automatic step up in basis again. So we're just dealing with this 1 year for deaths during 2010.
Okay, so the question is whether Oregon should give people an option as well.
an option, or that it just ties with whatever they've elected at federal, if they're going to, so that it ties.
Okay, so if they go for the estate tax at federal, they would go for an estate tax here, and if they went for a basis benefit at federal, they'd get that here.
And I think really what we'd like to see it achieve is that there's not a double tax on it. It's not an estate tax and then an additional income tax. So I think we need to work on the language of the law to make sure that that's the impact of it. Not trying to give anybody an extra benefit, but that we're not going to double tax them.
And I believe there's language to address the carryover basis issue in a separate bill sponsored by the Bar Association, or maybe revenue. Yeah, I'm not sure. But I don't think the due date is addressed in a separate bill, and I think that one is the most important to incorporate into this bill, if at all possible.
Okay.
So at least we have some time to work on the other one.
But we do bring it up because as part of our analysis of what we provide information about is all federal legislation enacted since your last session. So as part of that, it is part of the income tax piece, and so we just wanted to bring it to your attention.
And our recommendation C, which are the pieces that need to have some change made. So.
Okay.
So moving on from that, they get a little easier. Number 7 is just the tax-free health benefits that are now allowed for adult children under age 27. And so that's a new provision under federal law that we would not be connected to if we don't reconnect. The other, number 8, is startup costs. When someone starts a new business, they're allowed to deduct the first $5,000 of organizational costs, attorneys, accountants fees, that type of thing. And that's been increased to $10,000 at the federal level. The number 9 is the earned income credit. And for state purposes, and this is another one where I think practitioners get confused and talk back and forth with the Department of Revenue, but it's established at 6% of what the earned income credit is for federal purposes, and that typically is picked up in the reconnect tie that we would, if that credit is extended, then that would be picked up, and I think that is included in the proposed Senate Bill 301. And then number 10 is the $250 above-the-line deduction for teachers to deduct classroom expenses. So that's another one picked up. So I think with that...
Okay, I'm not seeing the tuition deduction on here.
It should be item 10 on the top 10 list. It's also in tab A. I'll find what page.
Basically, again, that's just a new provision under the law that allows a teacher to deduct rather than as an itemized deduction.
No, I'm talking about the tuition taxing deduction for college students.
Oh, for the state. We did not list that on our piece here, but you're right, and I know that's on the
revenue
piece.
It is in Section A with the asterisks somewhere.
And we just happened to not pick that up in our top 10. We probably... And I know that it was picked up by legislative revenue.
Yeah, it's one of the bigger tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it on Section A? What are these names of these programs?
It's on page 9 at the very bottom.
222E.
Okay. Okay, that's fairly substantial revenue impact.
Uh-huh.
Okay, could you just explain how that... Explain a little bit about that particular one, the 222E, are you prepared to do that?
So you're allowed to take a deduction for the tuition, and you can take a deduction or a credit. It was just an expansion of the old rules.
Expansion in what regard?
An extension of a rule, right, to 2010. And so because we're tied... as of December 2009, currently, we're going to disconnect from it unless we roll forward that date.
So I'm pretty sure that that was allowed for 2008 tax returns. This is just part of that extension that came through at the end of the year. So it has been permitted in the past.
Okay, so when we took the action that we did at the beginning of 2009 on the bonus depreciation, and when we took that action, we went ahead, we did not disconnect from this.
No.
Correct.
Right. Only the, right. the bonus and the, and there are specific statutes that disconnect us from, for bonus depreciation and the 179
correct.
Deduction, so. And I think that's where we would like to offer that once the committees know which pieces they'd like to disconnect from, that we'd really like to work with the language to make sure that the implementation really does work for taxpayers, because it is extremely confusing.
That's a deal.
And we know that there are several acts that are not mentioned in the Senate Bill 301 just because things came in at the last minute. So I think that there needs to be some adjustments, and I think everybody's aware of that. But we would very much like to work with you on that. And didn't try to propose anything now to just to work with you.
So getting back to the estate tax, right now 301 just has the, well, we probably should wait till the hearing, but I'll just ask this one question. Right now it just pertains to deadlines and not to the substance of.
And Senate Bill 301 doesn't even tie to the deadline.
Okay.
So I think that's what we're proposing, that perhaps at a minimum, without costing anything, that could at least let everybody know that they've got some more time to see what happens and to okay. to file it appropriately.
Would this be the time to open the hearing on 301? While we're talking about 301, I'm just going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 301, make sure that we're legal in this discussion. Okay. So we are in hearing on 301, so you're free to say anything about this particular document that you have, plus what's in 301 and what needs to change.
We would just, on behalf of the Oregon Society of CPAs, urge you to reconnect to the extent possible, understanding that we've got some economic issues, but conformity is so critical, and I think what we really see is that if we don't conform, it hurts the in-state our citizens more than it does those that live out of state, because what happens is an out-of-state tax practitioner isn't aware that we're not connected, and they don't follow the guidelines as well and actually pay less taxes. So conformity is very helpful, and it makes it a lot easier for all of our citizens to be able to follow the tax laws.
And this committee is very well aware of the need to get something out quickly so that the poor, long-suffering taxpayer can at least have an idea, and their long-suffering CPAs.
Get their credits where they're due.
And can have an idea of what the ground rules are for the 2010 mm-hmm. tax year. So we're very aware of that. Would you be prepared at this time to just go over some of the additions or changes that you see necessary to Senate Bill 301?
Chair Burdick, I guess part of it is what you want to tie to and what you don't want to tie to. I think we're not completely comfortable that the bill does maintain the rolling reconnect for 2011, and we want to make sure that we work with legislative council to make sure that it does do that. Otherwise, I think that we do need to update the effective date provision to include all of the bills that passed through the end of the year. And from reading them, it looks like there's a few that are missing out of there just because of the timing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the other piece that we know that we would really like to include is the extension of the due date filing for the estate tax returns. We would also like to see a change in the step-up and basis provisions, but if that gets in this bill or another bill, we feel like that really ties to the income tax pieces, and I think our feeling is it really would be best in this, and this is where somebody would be looking for that if information, but at a minimum to tie to those filing dates.
Okay. Anything else that...
No, as far as changes to the existing bill.
Okay. Now, is there anything more, and I'm sorry to kind of skip you around like this, but is there anything more on this excellent report that you wanted to go over?
We've covered all the items in Section C, which are the ones that would need specific action.
Mm-hmm.
and that are also included in the top 10 list we covered.
And we can go through Section A, but I think pretty much most of those are extensions of existing law.
Right.
The Health Care Act really did not have a huge impact on any tax issues. There were pieces of it, like the picking up the ability to exclude in the coverage for someone under 27. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think by being disconnected, we had, Kim was saying in her office, they had people concerned as to how to report on W-2s for Oregon purposes. Was it going to be different from federal purposes because we weren't connected? And these are the types of issues that pop up if we don't have rolling reconnect.
Mm-hmm. So we had several healthcare organizations trying to issue W-2s and concerned that they weren't reporting what they should be as far as taxable benefits for those dependents that were in that age range. And so there's definitely confusion out there among the taxpayers.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kim, we had a preliminary meeting a few weeks ago regarding the redefinition of dependent for health care. And I think it might be helpful for you to explain to the committee that it, how you value that coverage, that imputed value, which is not a value. Because I think we discussed the fact that, well, how much do you include on a W-2, number one? How do you figure that? And if somebody's already got a dependent covered, right, why would you have an additional cost? But I don't know that the committee understands the imputed value that we in Oregon are faced with and employers in Oregon are faced with, and just what we need is another impediment to business right now.
Right. So say, for instance, your family's health insurance costs $2,000 and you have one child age 25 and your other children are under the age of, say, 19, how do you decide how much of that monthly cost is attributable to that child that's age 25? And so, you know, employers and there's no information out there to be able to tell how much that costs and what value that has and whether it's going to be taxable for Oregon purposes only. So it's not taxable for federal, but should they be reporting that information on the W-2 for Oregon purposes only? This is a fringement or, you know, a taxable income item for them.
This is very, even if you like the idea of taxing it, it's very hard to get from here to there.
And no one's going to be the same. Everybody's going to report it differently.
Yeah.
It's not going to be conformity.
So I went into this meeting with one orientation and came out with another just because of the difficulty of it. Sometimes even if you want to go in a certain direction, it's so hard to get there that it hardly seems worth it.
And the reality is most W-2s have been issued. So, you know, I think the reality, unfortunately, is that they've been issued with nothing imputed and nobody's going to pay tax on this item. So really there's a lack of conformity, which gets back to our main point, is that to the extent possible, understanding budget constraints, it's so important to conform to federal because it is very, very difficult for people to understand the differences between federal and Oregon law because it's so widespread, and that's what all those asterisks are. And there are probably many others that we are not even aware of because of date changes and because there's so many federal laws.
Right. Are there other questions from the committee? Again, I really want to thank you for bringing your expertise. You do this every year. Every year now that we're in regular session. And we really appreciate it, and we especially appreciate it this year because so much happened right at the end of the year in Congress, and I don't know how we would sort our way through it. So we will accept your offer gratefully to work with the Committee on Amendments. We'll have a discussion at some point on whether I think it probably makes sense to at least be prepared to take your best shot at that income issue on the estate tax.
Okay.
Have it available for this bill if we decide to go that route. And again, if we don't go that route, we'll go another route. But to definitely get the deadline stuff done.
Okay.
Chris, do you have anything to add before we move on or any questions?
Well, I do have a sheet of some estimates.
Okay.
I don't know if we want to talk about that yet.
Why don't we wait till we go through our other witnesses, and then we'll get down to how much all these things cost.
And if I might add, I think we've got some questions on the cost estimates, and if we can help, some of them we're questioning whether there really should be a cost to it, which was the one we were, oh, the IRA distribution for charities. We were really questioning what, if that should be really be a zero. So if it comes down to something that's going to be excluded because of a cost benefit, we're not. And, well, and we realize it's very difficult to really estimate what these costs are.
If you have comments on this, I think I'll have Chris go through it now.
Okay.
Before we do our next, so that we won't have to drag you back up here again. Committee, do you all have this preliminary estimates for the various provisions? Okay. Chris, go ahead.
Okay, the sheet, these are the preliminary estimates for Federal Connect provisions, and there are two columns. For tax year 2010, it's a reconnect issue, as you're aware, so those, if you tie to these provisions, that would be the cost to the revenue stream. That's why they're presented as negative numbers. And for the column to the right, the 2011-13 disconnect, we are, again, as you're aware, we are tied to federal changes for 2011 moving forward. So if you wanted to disconnect from those provisions, those will be the revenue gain. Now, as of right now, the next forecast that you're getting next week will incorporate these changes. And the December forecast, these hadn't passed, so these revenue impacts weren't part of the baseline number. So the revenue forecast that you get next Tuesday will incorporate those, the right-hand column numbers in terms of the baseline. So that number that you get next week will incorporate the revenue loss from all of these provisions.
On the 2010 reconnect.
The 11-13.
The 11-13.
So for example, the bonus depreciation.
That's quite a lot.
Was not, the December forecast did not include that. That wasn't part of federal law.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
But come the forecast next week, it will include that revenue hit, revenue loss there, because it is now part of the current landscape. So after next Tuesday, if you choose to disconnect from that provision, it would then become, it would raise that amount of money.
So the forecast, Senator Haas.
That's like a swing of $160 million, that the forecast will be off, just by virtue of the fact that we haven't reconnected.
No, that we haven't disconnected for 11-13.
Right,
Right,
it's not part of the baseline number right now. Right. So to say right now, if you were disconnected, the number that we have in the current law forecast, that revenue loss is not a hit.
So that's, you know, if you look at 85 and 30, if we reconnect, we won't have that. Instead, it will be 34 minus 34 minus 18.
No.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm
reading it wrong.
There are two different issues. One is tax year 2010. That's the left-hand column.
We are disconnected from 2010 unless we choose to reconnect for 2010. This was a decision that was made in 2009.
Okay.
That
I guess
was
I'm looking at
23. The big vote that we had in 2009. Now, that same bill said in January of 2011 we get reconnected again. Therefore, we will have an $85 million hit from the expansion of the bonus depreciation at the federal level and a $30 million hit from the expensing.
Right. So in all the work that the state economist is doing right now and updating their projection, these costs will be part of that. Now, these are preliminary, I was at a meeting on Friday, but this is what I'm looking at right now in terms of the cost of these provisions. So when the state economists release the forecast next Tuesday, it will incorporate. This will be one of the changes to the forecast.
Right. And the only way to avoid this is if we took by a three-fifths vote, if we passed a bill by a three-fifths vote to disconnect from the federal tax code on bonus depreciation and expensing, then these numbers would not go in the forecast. Everybody understand? Okay, go ahead.
Well, conceptually, those are the columns, and then these are the top six. They're ranked by order of magnitude. There are a number of other provisions that have some kind of revenue impact, but generally they're less than $1 million. So rather than presenting a sheet that has every single one of them on there, these are kind of the big ideas. And so you get down, you can see how quickly you get down to policies that have an impact of $1 million or so.
Now, basically, we made the decision in 2009 on those first two items. We didn't know, we didn't do anything in 2000, did we? in 2009, we didn't know the tuition deduction was coming, right, Chris?
In 2009, if we go back to the 2009 session, that deduction was set to expire.
Expire.
As far as federal law. But federal law passed in 2010 extended it for 2 years.
Right. So we are not connected right now for 2010 for that $10 million. So of all these items, like dozens and dozens of items, this tuition expenses item is the biggest one. It's a $10 million, in other words, if we connected to it for 2010, it would cost us $10 million to do that. And so, Chris, could you explain how this compares to the tax credit for tuition, and what is the population of people who are likely to take the deduction versus the credit?
I believe the credit that is in question here are the federal, the HOPE, and lifetime learning tax credits. And they are, this might be a question better for the CPAs, but the way it's worked, you can't claim this deduction and that credit. So it's kind of an either or. So depending on the tax situation, the taxpayer, they may take this deduction and not the credits.
So is the federal...
They're federal tax credits.
Federal tax. So we don't have a state tax credit available. We
No.
just have the deduction. Okay, so what kind of taxpayer would take the credit versus the deduction, generally speaking?
Depends on the tax rates, and the credit is phased out at a different level than the deduction. So it really varies depending on their circumstances. And we always just, in fact, the software says optimize between credit or deduction, and it optimizes. So it will pull whichever is more advantageous. And even for myself, my husband went back to school to become a teacher, you know, in his 30s. So we 1 year may have claimed a deduction. The next year we may have claimed a credit for our tuition expenses. It just depends. But for Oregon purposes, you're right. There's no credit, and you would get the deduction for Oregon purposes because Oregon has a provision that if you claim a credit for federal purposes that Oregon doesn't have, you can then turn around and get the deduction on the Oregon return.
Oh, okay. So somebody in Oregon could theoretically take a federal credit and an Oregon deduction.
Yeah, either way, they're getting a deduction for Oregon purposes.
Okay.
This is how it would happen.
But it is phased out by income levels, and I don't have those right in front of me.
It's capped.
Yeah, I mean, it's capped. You don't get it regardless of how high your income is.
You don't get the deduction?
Yeah, the deduction and credit are both phased out for high income.
So that's why we capped.
Okay, well, this is something we're probably going to want to spend a little bit more time on, but we won't right now. Senator Telmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just ask Chris a question regarding his methodology on determining why these are tax increases or decreases? I mean, what are the parameters? What plays into that calculation?
It has, Senator Telfer, it has to do with where we are currently tied. And for tax year 2010...
Well, let me rephrase the question then. Obviously, if somebody can't do this, you're going directly black and white. Here's what, but we're not taking into account all the other ramifications of allowing kids to go to school and take a deduction, save money on their state taxes so that they can actually pay for more schooling, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you're not taking any of that into consideration, just the direct loss to the tax rolls. Okay.
If I may, do you know what dollar amount of tuition you're assuming to come to that $10 million? How that $10 million figure was derived?
We look at historical tax returns. So in terms of confidence in these estimates, there is a wide degree of variety. The tuition expense is probably the highest. We can actually look at tax returns for the past several years, look at those who have claimed it, and figure out the impact of removing that on taxes. The other extreme would probably be the health care coverage for young adults.
Which we haven't a clue.
That was one where, okay, I have to put a number down. And I did find some information where assumptions were made at the federal level for how many young adults would take advantage of this. And a number for this imputed value of the health insurance. So it's those numbers fall out of the arithmetic calculations of all those assumptions, and they're only as good as those assumptions, and they are a lot of assumptions.
It is a unique time in which we have like those two opposite columns, because in the first column you have revenue losses versus revenue raisers, because we're having to connect to for 2010 and disconnect from for 2011.
Right. Okay. Now, do you have any other comments about the chart before we go to other witnesses about the cost estimates?
The cost estimates. Did you want to go? Did you want to finish your list?
I just wanted to ask a general question. The loss or the gain to revenue by our reconnect is the sum of all of the column in 1113?
No, you should have put the pluses and the minuses.
No, I'm talking about for the period that we're in now.
Tax year 2010.
Yeah. But we disconnected, and the sum of that cost would have been the total of 1113.
The policy discussions about, and I'm not sure if I'm understanding the questions, but the policy discussion about reconnecting for 2010, the cost for that, if the legislature went to fully tie to all of 2010 law, it would reduce revenues by the sum of these numbers, plus some other odds and ends. And so that's why it would be a negative number, because right now we're not tied to those provisions. For 11 and for 1113, we are tied to them. They're just not in the forecast that they're not in the last forecast. They'll be in the forecast released next week. So the revenue loss to those, again, that direct revenue piece, that direct revenue loss, will be embedded in the number that you hear next Tuesday.
I guess maybe I'll ask my question, Madam Chair, a different way. The cost of the inconvenience, including the inconvenience to taxpayers, and the gain to the revenue for our disconnect is what? I'm trying to have a sense of what it is that we're gaining in our disconnect and have gained.
Are you talking about 1113 or 2010?
Well, I'm talking about we're disconnected, but we automatically reconnect as shown here in 1113. Right. What was the cost, total cost of our disconnect? I'm trying to put it in a perspective of what we cause a lot of grief, a lot of uncertainty, double accounting functions. And what did we gain for causing that grief? I guess that's when I say gain, what was the revenue, additional revenue by disconnecting?
For 2010, the disconnect, if we stay disconnected, it would be $65 million or so to the state. There's some other odds and ends, so maybe upwards of $70 million, but $65 to $70 million is...
For all of these.
For all. If the Assembly decides to not reconnect to 2010.
To anything.
To anything.
Well, and I'd like to point out, too, that this is a very short list. The long list of what we would be disconnected from if they chose not to roll it forward to 2010 is extensive. So you would have major non-compliance if you don't connect to 2010. I would strongly urge you to, if you need to disconnect from specific items, disconnect from those specific items so taxpayers are clear.
Or stay disconnected. Just don't reconnect.
Well, and yeah.
In the case of 2010.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
In the case of 2010, we're already disconnected.
Right, because we're tied through
but
December 2009.
But stay disconnected for the bonus depreciation.
But now we're connected. So to disconnect now.
No, we're not connected to
2011, we're connected.
Yeah. Right.
That's
but
what
we're
I'm
not,
saying now.
Yeah. But now we're trying to focus on 2010 and what to do about that right away before we even take up 2011. So the 2010, if we did anything, we're disconnected from this whole long list. So we have to decide what we want to connect to.
Retroactively,
which will have a revenue cost of some sort.
I guess, Madam Chair, what's behind my question is, if the purpose is to create additional revenue, to the state to backfill the problems we've got. Is this the most logical way to do it?
Well, you could argue that the decision on the two biggest ones was made in 2009. The decision was made to disconnect from the bonus depreciation and the expanded 179 extended. You could argue that decision was already made. On the other ones, they're relatively small. There's a whole bunch of them, and the aggravation factor far exceeds any revenue we're likely to get.
That's my point, Madam Chair.
Right. And so really the only one that jumps out as something that we probably have to have more discussion is the tuition expenses. That's a fairly big ticket item, and we are currently disconnected from it. And so that one is one that we probably need to have a little bit more discussion over. As far as I'm concerned, and, you know, I'll go with the will of the committee, but it's not worth the aggravation to stay disconnected from all those little tiny things that are just going to cause taxpayers to light their hair on fire and not give us much revenue.
And I might add the Department of Revenue might also want to light their hair on fire. It would be a lot of difficult, I mean, to try to disconnect from that many things would not only cause problems to taxpayers, but cost to them.
We light our hair on fire just for entertainment, so. All right. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Any further? Chris, do you have anything to add on this?
I don't think so. The intent of this was to provide that the distinction between actively reconnecting or actively disconnecting. Mm-hmm. And then again, this order of magnitude, there are a few dozen others that do have a small impact. So totaling these up doesn't get, well, I guess that's what I would add. Totaling these up doesn't get you the total for the reconnect because there are odds and ends that in a revenue impact statement I would include in.
Right.
And then also these were preliminary. Been looking in a lot of detail at bonus depreciation in Section 179. And at this past Friday, there was a revenue forecast advisors group with some CPAs and was trying to get as much input as I could on to what extent their clients will be taking advantage of these provisions. So, and as these things usually happen with two-handed economists, there are arguments for why these numbers would be higher or lower. And so I'm trying to modify these and get them final in short order for the committee.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much. Thanks again
thank
for coming.
You.
And we'll continue to keep you in the process as we hope to quickly put the final touches on Senate Bill 310.
We all thank you.
We very
thank
much you. Appreciate
Bill
it.
One.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We have a couple more witnesses. We have Ralph Groner and Bill Olson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing AFSCME. I will only take a few seconds. I've read your comments in the Oregonian and other newspapers, and I've tried to talk to Chris Allenack. You're stuck. I'm ambivalent because I read that the taxpayers need some certainty, and believe me, I know that. And I'm all for creating jobs, very much so. I don't really want to use the word problem. It's just I think we need at least a little bit of time. Congress had substantial amounts of time to debate this, and I know you don't have much. But it seems to me, if nothing else, we ought to have. I may as well admit this. I'm hearing impaired. That's my fault. There's no machine here, but I couldn't hear anyone but Chris, and I could hear Senator Telfer. Thank you. Your voices pound out. But I'm one who sits up front not because I'm a schmoozer, although I've been accused of that. It's because I really can't hear. I would hope that maybe quickly we could have a workshop somewhere in a room so that people who work in this building would have an opportunity for those same wonderful ladies who just spoke here and our wonderful staff and you could explain to people what we're facing in fairly clear terms so that and that ought to be able to be accomplished within a week. I'm not talking about a fancy hearing, but a workshop where people can really ask questions, have the folks here, the CPAs, present the program and have our legislative staff objectively present this, only so people feel fair. If they don't, what happens from my limited experience over the last 30 years is you end up with people saying, I can't vote for that because I just don't understand what you're doing. So I think we need to give people in the building, legislators as well as others, somewhat more knowledge about the complexities of this and just what the implications are.
Well, with all due respect, that's what this hearing was for.
No, I understand.
So if you have any questions, and also, do you understand that there's a difference between that we're going to have separate bills on the 2010 issue?
I did not, Madam Chair, I did not know that.
And so the 20, all these issues of whether to stay connected to the federal code in 2011 forward will be in a separate bill.
Oh, okay.
And that will be a more extensive conversation.
Well, thank you.
And we do intend to act quickly on the...
I understand that.
Okay, thanks. Question?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm co-chair of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee. I'm here to make a very brief statement. I frankly didn't think I understood things well enough to put anything in writing and have it thrown back at me later. But this conversation this afternoon has helped in that regard. Can I make an editorial comment? This whole discussion raises the question to me whether tax code spending is really the way to achieve public policy, but that's an aside. seems like we could simplify life if we didn't do so much of it. First of all, we understand and respect the desire of people to have simplicity in preparing their tax returns. I could even hope that my CPA might cut his fee if things were simplified. I'm not going to take it to the bank yet. However, given the context in which we enter this 2011-13 budget session of a huge deficit, we must express our concern and urge the committee to consider the relative priority of these tax expenditures to the cuts that are certain and they're being made. The governor in his statement, in the budget statement, talked about a 40% cut to long-term care services in the Department of Human Services. If you looked at the budget, you wouldn't find many line items in there. It's not very specific. We have a little more information, which I got Sunday evening, that in effect says in the long-term care portion of the DHS budget, which does not include DD or developmental disability services, which is another large item, we're talking on the order of $164.4 million in general fund reductions, and that's from the 2009-2011 budget. It's not the continuing service level as you've been familiar with in the past. And with the federal match, we're talking about a total of $396 million. Now, with those kinds of cuts, despite the governor saying you don't want to actually cut services, we're just cutting costs, the fact is that we know jobs are going to be lost, people are going to suffer reduction in services, and we're just trying to get things on a playing field where we look at dollars on a balance and say, is this particular tax expenditure more valuable to us than the services that we're going to lose over on the other side in ways and means? And I'm gratified that there is a joint tax committee that's going to be looking at all the cuts, and I hope being able to put that kind of balance in the in the mix, but we really want to see some shared sacrifice and a balanced approach to this budget, and we want particular concern to be given consideration for those people who are the most vulnerable in this society. And I think we know at least who some of them are, and I don't certainly know all of them or speak for all of them, but I think that's enough. That's all I can say. I have to go with the numbers that LRO has provided here. Just on that sheet alone, if I take the bottom three items of 8 million, 1 million, and 1 million without looking at them or bothering you with them again, that's $10 million. That's the cost of OPI, the general fund cost of Oregon Project Independence. That's just one example. And then we have a whole bunch of others, which I gather are small change, so to speak. But even that small change, especially if you could leverage some federal money with it, would be something. It would maybe take care of a line item or part of a line item. So I thank you for your consideration of the testimony. I hope we'll have an opportunity to put something in writing, but time may not permit that. I felt we had to be on the record today. Thank you. Well,
and I appreciate it. And you really did sum up exactly what this whole session is going to be about and why the special tax expenditure committee was created. It's because we are going to be trying to do that precise balancing act. But I want to make sure you understand, when you talk about that 8 million and 1 million,
oops,
that will be in all those numbers on the far right hand side will be in another bill that is looking to the future. And in order to change any of those numbers, we'll need a three-fifths vote.
I misspoke.
And
I'm
so
sorry.
What we're talking about right now is basically the middle column, and we're actually not having a serious discussion about those two first numbers. The number that I think we're going to be focusing on, just in terms of doing this cost benefit, is that $10 million number. Is this something we, you know, policy wise, does this make it up on the priority list? So I appreciate
right.
you coming.
There was one other point that I have to get in here, and that is that we're, unfortunately, Oregon and all the other states, as far as I know, are in a different situation than the federal government and our Congress, which feels free, apparently, to grant tax breaks willy-nilly without any consideration for the deficit, or at least, I'm making a policy statement
money.
Now.
They can print money, we can't.
We're in a very different situation, as you all know. I had to get it in.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. We have Steve Robinson signed up. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve Robinson. I have a consulting firm, Decision Metrics Public Policy Consulting. I just wanted to make a point regarding the it's kind of a more of a general comment about the first three items on the list, and it relates to both the 2010 and 20.
Are you talking about the financial impact?
The federal 10? Connect provisions.
Which
bonus depreciation, the 179, and the tuition expenses on this list here.
Okay.
And that is, I would really encourage you to think very carefully about any tax expenditures such as these that come up for either sunset review or proposals for new expenditures that you're considering during the session. And the way I'd like you to think about it is, are we rewarding behavior that would have occurred anyway in the absence of an Oregon credit or deduction piggybacked on top of a federal credit or deduction? And it seems to me that looking at particularly the bonus depreciation of the Section 179, a tiny Oregon effect on top of a significant federal effect is not going to achieve anything. There is no public benefit for those kinds of tax expenditures to take place in Oregon. In other words, we're giving money to people who are going to do what they were going to do anyway. And we're taking money away from programs that's going to cost jobs in Oregon in order to reward companies for the behavior that they would already have undertaken, which is not going to create jobs in Oregon. So these are so these kinds of tax expenditures are job killers. Okay, they cost jobs. They are bad for business. The only businesses that benefit from them are the businesses that would have done this, made these investments in any case. So why would we reward that behavior and cost the state's economy the kinds of why would we take away from the general fund spending that we would otherwise be able to make and the jobs that that spending otherwise supports in order to reward behavior that would have occurred anyway? So I just hope that as you look at these and other tax expenditures in the future, you'll keep that in mind. Let's make sure we are making effective use of these dollars and thinking about which kinds of investments would be stimulated, would be expanded because of the incentive that we're providing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Robinson, I guess where I'm going with this is your underlying data. I agree with you that we shouldn't be funding, incentivizing things that are going to happen anyway.
Right.
But, you know, in the last couple of weeks, I've had three clients come to me as a CPA and ask me, when should I buy this piece of equipment, how much should I buy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, 11% savings to them for just state taxes is significant in some of these purchases. So your testimony is contradicting that. So I guess what I'm looking for is what's your source of reference so that I can look at it?
Well, it there's a there was a study done by the Office of Government Accountability back in 2009 regarding the research and development credit, the federal research tax credit. And that's a that's an example of a rewarding an activity that for investing that you know the kinds of investments that businesses make. And they found that that most of the expenditures that tax credit supported would have been made anyway. And you know, frankly, on looking at the very small Oregon tax compared to the large federal tax, it is a logical assumption or a logical conclusion that the Oregon piggyback is not going to incentivize if the federal activity doesn't incentivize behavior to a great extent. How much less is the Oregon piggyback going to incentivize that behavior? So, you know, there may be clients that you have that are just on that cusp, but their investment, you know, that the federal credit, the Oregon credit would just take them over the top. But I think that logically it's going to be very few investments where that's going to be a significant factor.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I think that does it for us, right? Do you have anything to add? Okay, we will meet again on Wednesday.
Okay? Before you gavel out, just one point of clarification that was brought up in Senate Bill 301. This bill does not affect our rolling reconnect.
Yeah.
Got it. Just want a clarification for that question that was brought up.
Yeah. And there was some comment made by somebody that we need to make sure that technically remains the case, that it does what we need it to do. Okay, other questions? Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.